Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to be taking you on a little riff through exotic places and exotic ingredients, starting with Saffron Road, a company that specializes in halal and otherwise pure and top quality products. We'll be talking to Adnan Durrani, and listen to him because he's thoughtful with a mission and with first class products. Oddly, I discovered a company, Saffron Road, which is actually a subsidiary of an American halal company, through chickpeas when I was doing an overview of the Fancy Food Show. But when I read more about it, I realized that its founder, Adnan Durrani, has a much deeper mission than just producing snacks. Welcome to On the Menu, Adnan.
Thank you. It's my honor and privilege to be here, Anne. Thanks for inviting us.
So you founded American Halal. When and why?
I felt very strongly that in the complex world that we're in today, we needed, for me, it was a model around a mission-based goal of bringing different cultures together so that there could be a little bit more plurality in understanding of different cultures. And my history in food, I've been in the food movement, especially the organic movement, for over 25 years, and I've been very fortunate to see the social impact that really healthy food can have in terms of improving the world. And that was kind of my bold mission, was really to start a venture that could bring the concept of halal, which is in the dietary tradition very similar to kosher in the Jewish tradition, to a group of disenfranchised American Muslims or halal consumers going anywhere from 6 to 8 million strong, who had zero availability of any halal food on a national basis. So, you know, nationally, we're the only halal brand out there. But our goal or our mission was really to use this as a vehicle to bring understanding of different cultures, different faiths, different languages, and even different foods together in a common verse.
Now, where are you actually based, Adnan?
So we're based, our executive offices are in Stamford, Connecticut. Okay. We're sold nationally in all 50 states.
No, I just wondered where you had started out from. So you're in the New York metro area, really?
That's correct. We're in the New York City metro area.
And what was your previous involvement with food, organic food?
Well, my wife and I were the founders of Vermont Pure Spring Water, which is many, many years ago, which is now the second largest independent brand in the Northeast. I was a principal shareholder and partner in Stonyfield Farms Yogurt.
Oh, they're fine at Stonyfield's, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Gary Hirschberg was my great mentor there and still a good friend. And then I was involved in a company called Delicious Brands, where we started with a company called Frookies, which was the first fruit juice sweetened cookie in the market. And you may remember Frookies, and made quite a splash when we first launched. And we built that up to the fifth largest cookie brand in the country. And again, a socially responsible model about triple line, about giving back to community, society, as well as to your employees.
But now tell us about Saffron Road. I mean, there you narrowed your focus here, or expanded your focus, however you look at it, in terms of your mission.
Correct. So our mission, you know, while we might obviously have strong appeal to a core audience of American Muslim consumers, our mission was always much broader than that, and our model was never just based on just a Muslim consumer. We really felt that the whole idea of bringing a halal value system nationally had a much broader appeal to the natural food community. And indeed, today, 80% of our consumers are not even halal or Muslim. They're natural food consumers who really identify with our values around sustainable agriculture. So our approach really is what I call ethical consumerism, which is making sure that our values are aligned with holistic means of, for example, sourcing. We never use any factory farms. All of our farms are family farms. We make sure to source only livestock that is 100% vegetarian fed and antibiotic free or organic. We were the first non-GMO verified frozen entree in the world. Now we have 20 non-GMO verified products. We also believe always to, it's sort of an ethos about giving back and being socially responsible in our community with our employees. So yeah, that's kind of our mission, is ethical consumerism. It really is to restore the sacredness of our food with its relationship to us, to the earth, to our Creator, And then we offer 100% natural foods, which are also sustainably farmed. And as a result of our livestock, are hand-harvested. They use traditional methods. All of our production is done in home batch styles. So it's very mindful, the whole process.
Now, these are not your farms, though. They're farms that you've identified and who work with what you just described.
Right. We contract with them so they can work with our manufacturers, you know, our processing facilities.
Got
to
it.
Make sure they meet our protocol. So we might initially come among some family farmers that have really high-quality antibiotic-free or organic poultry or livestock, but perhaps their standards are not – they need to lift their standards a little bit more, because we also require that the livestock are either certified humane or humanely raised. And what does that mean? That means they have to follow certain established practices of humane farm animal care. For example, Temple Grandin sits on the – she's an advisor to – one of our auditors, which is Humane Farm Animal Care, that certifies our poultry as humane. So we believe that our practices are such that we don't want to source any livestock that has not been given a proper humane animal welfare. And we don't just like to say that. We want to make sure there's an auditor that's been in there and certified that the farms are at that level. If we find family farms that are really very devoted to sustainable agriculture and they're doing all the right things, but for some reason have not yet gotten their livestock up to that capability, we will work with them, maybe even help fund them to get them to a level where they can start to make sure their livestock have proper animal welfare. And when they do, then we go ahead and agree to allow them to compete to come into our supply chain.
Now, somewhere or other in your product line, there is also a fairly large number of chickpeas.
Yes. I think Ann has noticed that. Yeah, well, you know, we feel very strongly that health and wellness are a big part of our mission, and there is a strong movement away from your really unhealthy mainstream CPG companies' snacks out there into organic and what I call plant-based protein snacks. So we like to pick up on really old traditions and then bring an epicurean culinary element to them, and then also make them in a way that's much healthier and clean label. So when we launched chickpeas, first of all, we're the only organic chickpea launched nationally in America. There are several other competitors out now. But we felt that old tradition of hummus and chickpeas, and in general lentils and legumes, were a really wonderful way to get energy and fiber. I mean, 5 to 6 grams of fiber per serving. I mean, I'm sorry, protein, 5 to 6 grams of protein per serving. That's more protein than any other snack except for edamame. In other words, it's more protein. It's one of the few snacks that's more protein than fat. So we knew it had all the right health elements. We just cleaned up the label, made sure it was organic, and then we came out with some really innovative flavors. And the chickpea nut line has really taken off dramatically for us because we won
them.
A lot of awards. Yeah,
I
we've got a huge
them.
Fan here. Yeah, they are great, aren't they? They're a lot of fun.
Yeah, but I've always loved chickpeas. You know, from growing up, I ate chickpeas constantly.
Now there's a not completely filled niche you might be interested in, because and we found out about it the hard way, because our local greengrocer, who Anne goes to twice a week, who has a little corner store, actually had
fresh
chickpeas. And she was so excited, she bought them and brought them home, and they're practically impossible to peel.
Yeah, they're very hard.
they're difficult.
Hold on a minute.
Soak them in water overnight. Yeah.
So, it
is a really neat segment to be in, because people are understanding now how healthy those old traditions of legumes and lentils and chickpeas are, because of they're just very high in fiber. I mean, in the afternoon, you know, I always have them as a snack, as opposed to reaching for something sweet or something unhealthy or something fried, that like a potato chip or something, which is just going to drain you. The chickpeas actually give you energy. So we won a lot of awards for them, from Shape Fitness Magazine to Glamour to, you know, Rachel Ray. A lot of major, you know, culinaries have really called out what a great product that is.
Well, no, what I was going to go on to say is that I discovered that our local Whole Foods, and I'm sure across the country, they have flash frozen chickpeas, which have already been peeled by the time they're frozen. So they're really an excellent product. I wondered if that was a segment you were in, or whether or not, if not,
they're so much better than the canned chickpeas.
Yeah, they really are better than the canned ones. And well, they follow the Clarence Birdseye You know clams,
right.
Of course.
Yeah. I would assume that's more probably for cooking and soups and things like that.
Yes, that's what we use them for.
As opposed to fried for the snack, right?
No, we use them. I add them to various different dishes just because they're so delicious, and they give a different texture and a different flavor just by throwing a few handfuls in.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, I think I think we have some of those in our kitchen as well,
probably.
The frozen ones. Use instead of the can.
Now, tell me, you know, this. You were talking before about the analogy to the Silk Road, your saffron road. Could you sort of repeat a little bit of that and explain the reach of your company in terms of the range of cuisines you cover?
Sure. So, we feel that some of the best Epicurean dishes have come out of a mixture of different both exotic and traditional cultures. And if you look at our primary market is America. We only hire American workers. All our facilities are in U.S. and we're a U.S. company. But yet in America, you're seeing a lot of young millennials who are traveling quite a bit, and they're coming back with really wonderful world cuisine tastes. And our logo is to be the champion of world cuisines. And world cuisines today are not monolithic. I mean, it's really, we're living in a globalized American society. I mean, 112 Americans, 38% of America claims to have ethnic background. And so this young demographic, this young educated millennial consumer is very worldly. You know, they really want, they don't just want pizza anymore. They want to have high-end Korean food, for example, or they want to taste Indian foods or, you know, sometimes some of the European foods. So we understood that early in our genealogy of this company of Saffron Road, and we always felt Saffron Road should be adventurous. It should be a journey that we can all go on to and feel very comfortable and safe and trust that the journey of Saffron Road is going to be one that's going to welcome in adventure and world cuisines into your home table, but at the same time titillate your senses and titillate your taste buds to new levels of Epicurean enjoyment and inspiration. So that's kind of the theme around which we develop our products. So, for example, we started out with Pakistani and Indian, and we did four products in that area. And then we did a line of Thai products, which has been very well received. Our chicken pot Thai is not only is it gluten-free, but you would never know from tasting it that it's gluten-free, and it's one of the top sellers in the whole country among all chicken pot Thais.
And these are frozen.
And these are frozen. These are all frozen entrees. Okay. And then we have, we launched about a year and a half ago, a Korean line, and we're one of the only national Korean entree lines in the country. And we partnered with Annie Chung to exclusively develop that line with us. So we're always going to top shelf chefs, trying to work with them on a culinary level, but at the same time, something that can appeal to a mainstream, natural, organic audience.
So Annie Chung didn't view you as a competitor?
No, because she had sold out to a company called TJ Foods, which is from Green Glomerate. And then once I've known Annie for many, many years, and I said to her, as soon as you not compete with TJ's over, I want you to come work for us. And she did, and she honored her agreement, and she works exclusively for us now on entrees. So we worked together for over a year developing with our chef here, John Umloff, developing a really wonderful line of Korean entrees from gochujang to bibimbap. It's really wonderful celebration of the Silk Road, which was really big, you know, going through China and so on through the East. And then this year we launched a line that I'm very proud of, a Mexican line.
That's hard, and, too.
Yeah. And what I always felt was the biggest segment of the ethnic food industry is Mexican, and yet in America it's the lowest denominator. It's terrible what people eat in this country when it comes to Mexican selection. Mm-hmm. Low-end tacos and things like that. So most Americans don't really know high-end Mexican food, but the millennials do because they travel back and forth to Mexico and South America. So we partnered with Gabby Patrick, and Gabby's is rated as the number one Mexican restaurant in the whole state of California by Zagat. And, you know, there's thousands of Mexican restaurants in California.
Yeah.
And she is a culinary-trained chef. She comes from a background of really going to traditional Mayan, Yucatan, Mesa dishes. So we wanted to do something that was Mesoamerican, very high-end. We use handcrafted nixtamal corn tortillas. We're really looking at just the Yucatan region, and we're using Oaxaca cheese that's BST-free, really artisanal cheeses, in our enchiladas and the other Mexican products we've come out with. That line was just launched recently. It's doing extremely well. So our breadth is really about world cuisines. we're in four places in the store. We're in frozen entrees, and then we have a line of simmer sauces, both Indian, Thai, Korean, that we have, which are in pouches, which are environmentally a lot better than cans or jars. They're free of all the toxins you have in cans, and as well as no breakage like you have in jars. And then we also have a line of halal broths. We're the only halal antibiotic-free broth in the world that's in Tetra Pak, which is free of 67 toxins that you find in cans. And then lastly, we have, as we mentioned, you know, the chickpea snack line. And we recently bought out a company called Mediterranean Snacks. We just announced it last week, which is the leader in lentil snacks. And so we're going to continue to build out our platform of plant-based protein snacks.
We're great customers for lentils and mung beans, sprouts.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
We'll have to send you some coupons.
Right.
Just to share with your friends, yeah.
Right. Well, I think you got on to something, and for the right reasons, and you've not run into any. I explained to you that we have a project in Pittsburgh that started out as an art project called Conflict Kitchens. And it's they rotate their menus for the different countries that the U.S. is in conflict with.
And I just saw this on Cuba there. Right, right, right.
And yeah, and there was a huge uproar over this Pakistani-Israeli thing. I can't remember what it was. Somebody wrote something on the wrappers of the food.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so
you see past versions. It says Afghanistan, North Korea, Palestine, Iran.
Yeah. So maybe it was Palestine, whatever it was. There was this huge furor over it. People were picketing and everything.
Really?
Yeah. So
that's craziness.
But you don't have anything like that. You find it all smooth sailing.
Well, obviously we have our growing pains as a business. We're growing at such a rapid rate, and we've been very blessed with that growth. But when we first launched in 2010, but nationally we were out there in 2011 with Whole Foods as our primary retailer. Yes, we did have some blowback from some of the Islamophobes and Islamophobic bloggers that are out there, but we anticipated that, and we know that, for my experience for, you know, 3 decades in the food business, is that America is a very pluralistic place, and that, you know, there's open discussion. I mean, people want to have discussions on any topic. That this is America, they should. You know, I believe in that. I believe in free speech, and so there was pretty fiery discussion, you know, going on as to how our brand was able to scale in the light of everything going on, the discussions going on in this country. And I had to clear the air. I actually had to go on CNN, clear the air, because CNN called me to do an interview, which I did, and our sales soared 600% after the interview.
So in spite of... did well.
Yeah, well, I got lucky. I always say the angels are looking over us, but, you know, we're higher powered, as I like to say, thank God. But I had a lot of friends. My Jewish friends helped me. Various rabbis stood up for us. We had a lot of people from, you know, the various church groups and business leaders who really supported us, because, you know, we really are about bringing different cultures and faiths together in a tolerant world. And many people, not many, but some, there's a very, very small minority of xenophobic, you know, very racist people, unfortunately, out there who would like to put a wedge into that kind of thinking. But unfortunately, as Victor Hugo would say, nothing can stop an idea whose time has come. And, you know, the time has come for us to have pluralistic dialogue in a tolerant America.
You are a genius.
I don't know about that.
You're on the
wife.
Right side, and you're really a good moderator here.
And I think it runs in the family, because you mentioned before we went on the air that you and your son are headed on an interesting adventure. You're going to.
That's right.
You're going off to.
We're going to back to your alma mater.
Yeah, you're going back to. And your son is taking a master's in philosophy at Darwin College. And I have two pieces of advice for him.
I'm all ears, as Ross Perot would say.
Waterproof shoes.
Waterproof shoes, that's a good one, right.
And warm clothes.
And warm clothes, okay. From New York, you'll have some clothes, but maybe not warm enough.
The ground is wet, the air is foggy. starting in November and going to about March.
Right. Oh, that's great advice, Peter. Thank you. I'll make sure to mention that to him.
And I didn't have all of those myself, so I suffered just a little bit. But he'll have a wonderful experience there, and I'm sure you'll have.
What a great school! What a great university!
Oh,
what a
so
wonderful
beautiful.
Campus!
And what a great
faculty!
And what a great opportunity you have to go and explore one of the most interesting cities probably in the whole world, I think.
Anyway, Cambridge, really. Yeah.
Anyway, we appreciated your talking to us today.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's my pleasure, and I feel privileged, and thank you very much.
Thank you, and continued success.
Thank you. Wonderful week to you. God bless both of you.
And we'll be back with the story of another exotic ingredient right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Up next is an exotic ingredient that has gotten a lot of attention lately after having fairly a bland reputation, because of now we've been introduced to the real thing, from the pod, vanilla beans. And the Vanilla Table is a book to really sit up and take notice of. We've received many books on vanilla, and this one is exceptional. From the illustrations to the data that you won't get anyplace else, to absolutely top-notch recipes from some of the world's best chefs.
It's one of the coolest books as well, in terms of describing why this product is, why is it called what it's called, how is it made, if you can say. So it's really a fascinating story.
So listen to Natasha McGallar.
I really felt approaching this book, which is so beautiful, it's hard to explain on radio, The Vanilla Table, or Vanilla Table, by Natasha McCullough. Is that right, Natasha?
Yes, it is.
It's as close as I can get. Anyhow, it's like, to me it was like, first of all, I love stories about vanilla. It's so exotic, and it's... You know, people don't even have a clue about how exotic it really is in terms of how you have to pollinate it, but the little bee or by hand, and the places are all exotic that grow it, and it's an orchid. Will you tell us all about that in the opening? And then you've invited an absolute blue ribbon crop of chefs, and yourself included, to give recipes, and the recipes are not just vanilla recipes. These are gorgeous, really unusual, off the charts in creativity that you've included in this book. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you so much, Anne.
Now, you've done so much. I think we would be negligent if we didn't mention the fact you started out as a ballerina.
Yes, it's true.
And then you were on stage in musicals.
Yeah, but she was a ballerina, but she doesn't have a dessert named after her.
No, that's
no,
true.
I don't.
There ought to be at least something equivalent of a pavlova.
Well, I do pay tribute to my idol when I started dancing, and the Anna Pavlova, and have done a little twist on the classic Pav, as what? They say in Australia and
yeah.
New Zealand.
Well, I was going to ask you. How come you couldn't figure out what to do when you grew up? but you've actually done it twice.
And, yes.
And although you're not a native of Kiwi land, you must have spent a fairly large amount of time there.
Yes, I'm a great appreciator of New Zealand, absolutely, and Australia.
Yeah, well, Peter Gordon, of course, who's probably one of the major chef exports of New Zealand, does the foreword to your book, and he likes you a lot. I mean, he's really fond of you and an admiration of you.
Oh, he's such a darling, a generous man, and I've never seen him be flustered. We've known each other for many, many years, and I've seen him put together enormous, complex events, and he just keeps his cool, he keeps his creativity, he's just passionate about his craft, and I hope a little bit of that has rubbed off on me.
Well, you start out with your introduction to the vanilla story, saying that vanilla is your passion.
Oh, absolutely. It is my passion. It started from a very young age with some vanilla perfume my mother used to spritz me with on the way into the ballet studio every day. And it's just, it has such a exuberant and elegant memory. It's only continued to grow and continue to I'm very fond and love it, and it's very inspiring to me.
Now, most people only know vanilla as a flavoring for ice cream. So let's have you take a couple of minutes, and as Anne mentioned earlier on, just a few minutes ago, why don't you explain vanilla, what it is, and then what it becomes?
Okay, I will be happy to. Vanilla is actually the fruit of a flowering orchid, and it grows 20 degrees north and south of the equator. When the flower blooms, it has to be pollinated within a matter of hours from sunrise to about midday. Otherwise, the flower withers and dies, and you don't get a vanilla bean.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's so. There's one place in Mexico which originated the pollination of the vanilla bean, and that was through a very feisty bee called the Meliponia bee, which is found nowhere else on Earth. And because of this, it was hard to make it into any sort of commercial product. It was sought after by the old royalty of Mexico, the Mayans, the Aztecs, as a very exotic, which it remains to this day, spice and flavoring. And a slave on Reunion Island, Edmund Albus, discovered a way to pollinate the flower before it withered and died by using a tiny little toothpick-type tool to pollinate that flower, and then was able to grow vanilla beans successfully. And when it's first picked, it's green. It looks just like a green bean, which is why we call it a vanilla bean, as opposed to its actual scientific pod name. And there, it is cured in the sun or with varying methods which give it different qualities for 6 to 9 months until it's supple and brown and shiny, and that's when you actually smell the aroma of vanilla, not when it's originally picked. So it's extraordinary how it must have ripened on a vine a long time ago, and people were captivated by the smell, and it just took off from there.
Well, now, how often do you encounter pods that have this coating of vanillin?
Oh, consider yourself very lucky when you see that lovely coating of vanilla. It looks like white dust, and it is indeed vanillin, which is the most the strongest component of the many, many flavor components in a vanilla bean. And it's so look for it if you see it. If you see that on a vanilla pod, buy that one.
Yeah, and I've never seen it, actually. But you say that the vanillin is the strongest of the 250 organic chemical components found in a cured vanilla pod. That's amazing.
It's absolutely extraordinary that it's so complex. And yet you think vanilla is not only used in ice cream and cakes, it's found in things like dryer sheets and cola products.
Yes,
A friend of mine who's a builder, he says he actually puts a little bit of vanilla extract in big pots of paint when painting walls because it takes that terrible smell away of paint.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
You have freshly scented walls.
Now, let's put in another secret here, and that is that a lot of the vanilla that's out there, that people will be tempted to buy because it's less expensive, is actually an artificial chemical of some kind.
Yes, it is, and I when I ask people, I ask if they have imitation vanilla in their cupboard, and I say, great, use it to clean your floors, not ingest it.
It works for cleaning your floors, huh?
It works great cleaning your floors.
gives you an idea what it's good for.
Exactly.
Well, that makes sense. You could have a vanilla coat, clean the rust off your metal with the coat.
That's right.
And throw the vanilla.
Now, I thought one of the most interesting things about this book, because we associate the vanilla with dessert, not entirely fairly, I'm sure, but I don't think I've ever seen a collection of recipes quite so large where vanilla is used as a flavoring for pre-dessert, for meat yeah. and other kinds of things. So did you invent that, or did your guest chefs invent that? I mean, how did it get there?
It was a very interesting adventure. As the chefs became involved, the star chefs became involved with the book, they were excited to create things. And I was a few dishes came in. I was quite skeptical. One of them uses tomatoes, Peter's dish, for instance. There's actually a few that use tomatoes, and I thought, tomatoes and vanilla, not sure. And it's absolutely amazing. What I've discovered writing this book and testing everything and creating dishes is that it works amazingly with umami, which is that fifth flavor.
Yes.
So Jonathan Waxman, for instance, does a dish called chicken stroganoff with chanterelles and vanilla.
I saw that.
And vanilla.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that one.
And I couldn't. I was very skeptical. I tell you, we made the dish to photograph it, and we couldn't stop licking the bowl. It was absolutely divine.
Oh,
just
that's
heavenly.
Amazing.
And easy to make, too, on top of it.
I've known of the affinity that vanilla has for seafood, particularly, remember Rabbitoni Pies used to make that lobster with vanilla.
I actually don't remember.
Yeah, well, he did. It was great.
Yes, lobster is a classic dish to pair with vanilla. But I've got salad dressings in there and oxtail pot pies with vanilla Shiraz gravy.
Yes,
and it's absolutely divine. You slow cook, you know, for the winter months, you slow cook whole heads of garlic and shallots and carrots and parsnips and whole vanilla pods, and you just let them simmer down with some Shiraz wine. And some other vegetables, and then your oxtail, and you just let it slowly cook down and make this beautiful, beautiful broth, and then reduce it down further and put it in a little pie with a lovely pastry crust, and it's absolutely gorgeous.
But now you point out something I didn't know at all. Well, a couple things I didn't know. I didn't know you could keep the pods for 2 years. That's number one thing that kind of flabbergasted me. But you also point out that different from different places, so mm-hmm. it might be varieties, or go with certain products, I mean other dishes, like vanilla from one place. It has characteristics that makes it good with seafood, and then the Tongan vanilla goes better with such and such. And what could you run through that?
Certainly, there's four major distinctive styles of vanilla. Are the real workhorse, the classic one, is Madagascar, also known as bourbon vanilla, and there is no bourbon in bourbon vanilla.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people ask me that. It goes great with bourbon, however, I must say. But it was originally the slave Edmund Albus who discovered this. It was the island of Reunion was originally called Ile de Bourbon, because it was owned as a French island, and it was owned by the Bourbon royal family. So that's why it's called bourbon vanilla. So that's the real workhorse. It's the classic. It has hints of rum, raisin, brown sugar, and it works for everything across the board. The most different style is Indonesian, which is actually cured near an open flame, so it has smoky characteristics. It's not a vanilla of the highest quality, per se, but I'm sure there are now. Indonesian vanilla is growing and growing in its acreage, but it's great for slow-cooked items to throw in a crock pot or into a soup, or it's got that lovely smoky characteristic, and it puts up with long cooking. Tahitian, on the other hand, is very light. It works beautifully with creams, sponges, fruit, and it's grown in a very small area in the South Pacific. And it's a different variety to the Madagascan vanilla, and it's very delicate, and it's slightly more expensive, and it's used and loved by most pastry chefs. And so there's different...
Why do you lay your hands on these different things? I mean, does everybody stock all these different styles?
I want to say in America, Nilsson Massey does carry Madagascan, Mexican, and Tahitian. The Indonesian is available, usually supermarket grade vanilla is either Madagascan or Indonesian. Indonesian is a little less expensive. Tahitian is a little more expensive.
I see.
Yes.
Let me tell you this. Knock your socks off on dessert is this Tonga trifle. Walk us through that one.
Oh, that was a moment of madness on the island of Tonga where we did a big food and wine event. And I just decided to create this crazy fun trifle, which I have a great picture of one of the New Zealand iconic cooks, Tui Flower, who was probably of 89 years old now. Bless her. She's just extraordinary. We put this massive bowl before her, and it's made with layers. It's not your Nana's traditional trifle. There's no Madeira in it. It's made with a rum cake, and it's got layers of caramel sauce, hot fudge, white chocolate pastry cream, all, of course, containing vanilla, and it's finished with toasted almonds and coconut, and it's got layers of bananas in there, and then it's topped with vanilla candied bacon bits.
Yeah, but that was your claim to fame here.
And when you get to the bottom of the dish, there's a little note in there that says, please make an appointment with your doctor as soon as possible.
Yes, exactly.
It is spectacular. You also, I might point out, have a great section on drinks using vanilla because everybody's sort of into this cocktail culture now.
Oh, absolutely.
And a list of what goes into your pantry, such as vanilla syrup, vanilla sugar, raspberry curd, English toffee. All in all, this is like a book that's going to get you cooking. I mean, this is it.
Absolutely. I hope that it just inspires people to create their own memories. And I think having memories and stories about a dish makes the food taste better.
Uh-huh. And just quickly, I mean, I've used to get the Vanilla Queen, Patricia Raines, newsletter, which I think has gone under at this point, but she was apparently conditions for these, the workers for on vanilla plantations are pretty bad, huh?
From what I've read, yes, they are, especially in places, you know, Madagascar, which grows so much vanilla. My only experience is with this organic fair trade vanilla plantation in Tonga, owned by a small New Zealand family who were inspired to help this impoverished island in Tonga, and they work in conjunction with the Latu family, which is a native local family, and they work together, and they share, they give back to the community, and they're making beautiful vanilla. So, my experience is quite different than what one reads about
right.
Other areas.
Well, Natasha McCullough, you are absolutely, you should feel proud of this book. It's a treasure called Vanilla Table, and. I swear, listeners, that you're going to start cooking, even if you don't think you are. You can't wait to taste the recipes in this book. Natasha, thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, and thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
It was worrying me all the time we were doing that interview, and now we're recording it into a program to try to remember why it was so memorable. And what it is, it's the home of that wonderful dessert called Tonga Trifle.
Oh, yeah.
Which is such a magnificent recipe. I send it to my cousin in England who likes to make desserts. And he's going to make it sometime, and you're going to want to make it too. It's the most wonderful layer trifle you've ever seen in your whole life. And
many layers, extravagant, over the top, wonderful.
And interestingly enough, dedicated to the island of Tonga, which is a producer of some of the world's
best
vanilla.
Yeah, which I never knew, even though I was on Tonga. Yeah. Yeah,
there you go. So this is not something to ignore. This is not vanilla in vanilla ice cream. This is vanilla that will enrich your taste buds in ways you can't imagine.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again. We've been following Lonely Planet since its very beginnings, which really was more about backpacking than anything else. Now it is truly a power publisher in the travel industry. And I am so excited about its new series called From the Source. We have two cookbooks, one from Thailand and one from Italy, and there's more to come. Listen to the one personally responsible as editor, Jessica Cole, talk about Lonely Planet's From the Source cookbook series. I was just recalling with Jessica Cole, who's going to be our spokesperson for this latest Lonely Planet series, that I remember the earliest books issued by Lonely Planet, guidebooks that seemed aimed directly at long-haired backpackers. And I was saying, Jessica, Lonely Planet has come a long way from that beginning.
I think it has, yeah, it has. We've broadened our appeal quite a lot. We hope to appeal to lots and lots of different kinds of travellers. But I think travel itself has broadened in the last 40 years, and there's a lot more people who are interested in seeing the world now.
Right. Well, I honestly can't keep up with all the Lonely Planet books that are published. There's so many of them. I mean, Best Brunches in the World, and, well, but we're here talking about a particular new series that I was very impressed with. It's called From the Source. And you are, what is your exact title there, Jessica?
I'm commissioning editor for the trade and reference titles of Lonely Planet. So that's all these sort of food and drink books and reference and gift titles.
Oh, that's a big job, dear.
It is a big job, yeah.
This series, I only have one. I have the Italy, and Italy happens to be a country I know very well. So I could look at it and see that you were meeting your claims that this is really authentic recipes from the people that know them best. And a lot of the people in this book I know very well.
Really?
Oh, yes, of course. We're there once or twice every year.
Oh, great.
We meet up at different food events.
Yeah, it's really funny to have what we call him, the king of Culatello.
Oh, yeah.
Chef Spigaroli is number one. And the number two restaurant in the world, Osteria Francescana's Massimo Bottura, as the second recipe. You're starting on a high point. You almost have to slide downhill from there.
Absolutely. That's no bad place to start, is it?
Yeah, well, back up and give us the overview, because this is clearly a series that's going to go on for a while. I think I counted 2 years.
Yeah, so we've started with the first two titles that have just been published. That's Italy, as you mentioned, and Thailand. And the idea really behind it was we've done some food publishing, you mentioned, in the past, but we really wanted to bring together the travel world that we knew so well and the best of the food world. And we think that those are two things that work very well together. And we thought that what Lonely Planet could deliver was bringing readers right to the heart of the cuisine and having that authenticity by going straight to the cooks themselves instead of using a middleman.
The photographs are wonderful too, by the way. They're just up close and personal of all these people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice to see some personalities in there, isn't it? And the food shots, it just makes you hungry, really, I think.
Yes. Well, I'm looking at Christina Bauerman here in Italy with her pink hair. I've been debating dyeing my hair turquoise.
Right. You should do it. Absolutely.
So how does it work? How do you gather this information and these recipes?
Well, we sent out our authors and our photographers. So for the Italy book, we had one author and a photographer. And in our Thailand book, we actually used authors who were also photographers, two of those. And the way they decided on the dishes, well, it was based on recommendations, on research, and just popular opinion. You know, the street market stalls with the huge queues are usually busy for a reason. Right. And they use their, they're all extremely experienced in the world of food and in that country. So they just use their experience and their contacts to find the very best cooks and the very best recipes.
Well, now, how many books will be in the series?
Well, we hope there'll be a lot. We've got another two already in the pipeline. So next year we are publishing From the Source Japan and From the Source Spain.
Wow.
And we hope to continue to roll that out over the following years with a couple every year.
Oh, I want those too.
Here's a question for you. When are you going to do From the Source Britain?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? You know, British food is, it's come along a long way, but I think a lot of British food is based on different cuisines from other people. Our own is quite hearty food, but I don't know how many have originated from this island itself. So, yeah, that would be an interesting one to try.
Oh, new British cuisine and also Maud Oz cuisine. I mean, they're both, I think, distinctive cuisines.
Yeah, when you get around to thinking about that, Peter and Anne will do it for you.
Gotcha. Okay. Absolutely.
We'll do From the Source Britain.
We've
probably been more places than most. I'm originally from there, and around the time when you had to apologize for the food, and everybody laughed at me when talked about British cuisine. But that is in the last 25 years. That's clearly changed. And on the menu has a variety of missions. One of them is to make sure the world understands that that's true.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and living in London here, we're very lucky to have some of the best restaurants in the world, all at our fingertips. So, yeah, we can't complain, really.
You bet, Dan. They're great.
Mm.
Now, how do you, is there like a committee? How do you decide which countries you're going to do?
Yeah, it's sort of a committee. We just sort of talk about we want to get a broad range of places to discover, you know, at the start. And then we really want to make sure that there's lots of regions that we can explore within that country, and usually there are. And what people are interested in reading about, really. So that's one of the biggest concerns is, you know, what kind of cuisines are people really getting involved with and wanting to learn more about the background and learning to cook with it, really. So that's kind of where we start. And then there are lots of discussions, and then we end up coming up with a final decision. So, yeah.
But you're only going to do like two a year?
Yeah, it'll probably be two a year. It takes a long time, actually, to create them. The authors and the photographers have to find these restaurants and the chefs, and they have to go and they meet them, and they spend a whole day shooting with them, talking to them, interviewing them, and finding out just how they are influenced by the cuisine and how, you know, the community is involved with that. So it's quite an involved process. It takes, you know, upwards of 8 months or a year for them to gather what they need for us to start making the book.
How do you decide? I mean, who makes the cut? Spigarola and Bottura, they're kind of easy.
Absolutely.
Some of the other chefs we know, some of them we don't know, but we know their style. I mean, how do you get close enough to the ground to be able to figure out which ones to ask?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a case of being very experienced in travel writing and knowing your country. So, for the Thailand book, I edited the Thailand book, and for these writer-photographers have lived in Thailand for years and years. Their food, the food is, you know, their passion. It's their lifeblood, really. And they've, it's, you know, although it's taken a year for them to gather these things, actually it's all about getting under the skin of that culture for years and years. And just talking to lots of people in the industry, really, and, you know, talking about what are the most exciting and interesting chefs out there in the market at the moment.
So you've got local underground experts who are relying on the knowledge they already have.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the beauty. We have, because we write so many guidebooks at Lonely Planet, we have over 200 authors, writers on the road at any one time. They all live all around the world. Yeah, so it's a fantastic source of information, source of, you know, of travel wisdom all around the world, and we're very lucky to have those people.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned the travel wisdom there, as well as the cooking wisdom, which is reflected in this book, because this book really has two audiences, I think. And let's just define what I think they are, and then you can comment. First of all, it is a cookbook. It has classic recipes of the country in it, as interpreted by some of the top chefs in all regions of the country. So that's one starting point. So you can put it on your bookshelf just for that reason. The other wonderful thing about it is it's a wonderful travelogue. In fact, it's got dots on a map of Italy, all of which are places that if you're traveling, thinking about traveling Italy, you ought to go. Interesting that in the years we've been going to Italy, which now is 20 years or more, we've been to very many of them, but there are a few we haven't. And I would use it as a travel guide as much as I would use it as a recipe book.
Well, that's great, and that's really what we wanted to achieve with these books. You know, there are lots and lots of cookbooks out on the market, and what we thought we could bring as Lonely Planet was that ethos, the travel ethos of the long-held expertise that we have, and our sort of knowledge of the places and people. And, you know, that's why we didn't want to just create a cookbook, because actually we have a really... The people that we work with have such an interesting angle, looking at, you know, how communities and how landscapes have, how regions have influenced the cuisine. And we wanted to bring that to the readers.
Well, there's some clever touches in here. I'm looking at, first of all, I'm drooling over this photograph of cannoli. I mean, hello, that's my favorite food. And then you have this little illustration, like just sort of a throwaway illustration of the outline of Sicily in rosary beads. That's very clever.
Yeah. Yeah, lovely little illustration. Just, you know, perk up the page, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that I wanted to mention that simply to bring up the concept that these books are very, very sophisticated books. This is not, you know, a throw-off kind of travelogue or anything, or a cookbook. They're very sophisticated and in-depth. I can't say how pleased I am to see them, to know that it's happening. And do you have any other you'd like to sort of preview for us?
Well, absolutely. You know, as soon as the new ones are on their way, then we'll send them through to you, and hopefully you'll like them just as much. I'm very glad that you rate them, and you know, there's lots and lots of time and expertise has gone into them, and it's great to know that's come off into the product we wanted, really. So, yeah.
So, what other countries besides Japan and Spain? They're both good. Any others?
Yeah. Well, we are thinking about France.
That's a major effort. I
mean. Yeah, well, exactly. It's a huge undertaking, and it's quite a different approach actually for France, because that will be the first place where it's not so much that in Italy and Thailand, and even in the ones that are being created now, Japan and Spain, it's all about sort of handing down the recipes from, you know, from mothers to daughters, from grandmothers, and it's really a, you know, tradition of within the family. But in France, you know, there's a huge tradition of great chefs, and it's quite a different approach. So that will be an interesting one to cover. I think that's probably on our radar. Malaysia also, which has just a huge range of different kinds of cuisine within it. And lots of other ideas, really. We talked about the Caribbean. Absolutely, it is.
We just interviewed the author of a Senegalese cookbook. Whoever thought Senegal?
Oh, really?
He's absolutely amazing.
And, incredible.
So the whole of West Africa, in a sense, I guess, is a region that has a lot of region variation, but there are themes in the other countries that surround Senegal, I guess. And then the fascinating thing is the cross-Atlantic pollution.
Pollination.
Absolutely.
It's really funny. That's Massimo Bottura's pollution is his word for describing for describing how different countries are influenced others. I keep on trying to remind him that pollution in English is not a good word.
Yeah, absolutely. Pollination is probably the better way to describe it.
To end up where it began, because we're talking to you this morning, or this afternoon, your time in London.
Jessica Cole.
We have volunteered to do the United Kingdom on the Britain, Scotland,
absolutely,
Ireland and Wales, when that comes out, together or separately, because we think there's a story to tell there as well. And we can't wait to follow you around the world, because we're always interested in traveling new places if we're not interested in cooking new foods. So,
absolutely.
So this series is one that's going to give Lonely Planet new relevance to us.
And it will give Jessica a long-term job.
Oh, that's also pretty good.
Oh, yeah, I'll never be able to rest.
Oh, it's an endless project, yes.
It is.
Well, much luck to you, and not luck, you don't need luck, much success. And
thank you, Anne.
Great that you took the time to cross transatlantic, I guess we'd say, right?
Absolutely. No, thank you very much for having me. It's been great chatting to you both.
Right. See you then, Jessica.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
So if you're interested in travel and food, as we are, this is a series to watch. This is a series to own. This is a series to use.
Especially use.
So it's going to become part of our bookshelf, that's for sure. And that's all for this week. And until next week, we'll see you same time, same place, we hope.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.